We've had him before, and welcome to our Saturday podcast. We want to bring him on again, Gautam Chopra. He's an author, a filmmaker, an entrepreneur, director and executive producer of Kobe Bryant's Muse, a Showtime doc wonderful on Kobe's career. Or maybe you know him as the creator and director and EP of Tom vs. Time, the Tom Brady docuseries on Facebook, which we must have spent 10 shows diving into. Gautam is now helping direct Tom Brady's production company, 199 Productions. The first series is called Unseen Football, and Gautam Chopra now joins us. So let's start with that, Gautam. How are you, first of all? How are you dealing with the virus? You and your dad have a podcast we'll get to later on that, but how are you and your family doing?
Thank you for asking, and thank you for having me. We're doing well. You know, we're hunkered down and being compliant with all the restrictions. Everyone's healthy, and actually just, you know, it's been an amazing time, I think, to reflect on just, you know, so many of the good things that are happening. So that's kind of where we tried to stay focused, but very eager, very much missing, like, the NBA playoffs, et cetera, right now. But, you know, hopefully sooner than later we'll see some version of normal returning.
Yeah. Now, are you living in an urban setting? I'm out in Los Angeles. I've got a backyard. You know, it's more the suburban feel. Are you in that setting or a more urban vertical living setting right now?
No, I'm West Side LA. So, you know, have space, go for runs every morning. And yeah, again, I mean, it's an incredible luxury, frankly, to be able to be outside. The weather's turned beautiful, et cetera. So we're lucky in that sense.
So let's go to the first series of Tom Brady's new production company, 199 Productions, Unseen Football. What is that?
So Unseen Football, I mean, it's a product of this amazing meeting that I was a part of with Tom and the Russo brothers, you know, the Russo brothers of Avengers fame. So
yeah.
It was everything you would imagine when, you know, probably the biggest filmmakers in Hollywood and Tom Brady meet, which is like a huge idea and just like big and a spectacle. It's envisioned for IMAX, so like the biggest screen you can imagine.
Oh, I love that.
And really exploring football as a cultural institution. So less like a traditional film and more of a visual spectacle / experience. And, you know, we're huge NFL fans. The Russo guys are from Cleveland, so they're Browns fans. And that, you can imagine that came up. There was a bit of trash talking from Tom. But it's also just like at every level, from college to high school to peewee, you know, why we love football so much.
A film, not a documentary, right?
Yeah, like a visual experience. Like, you know, when you go to the museum or you go to an IMAX, so not like a feature film, but more like a 40-minute experience. I'm really sort of voyaging into the heart of football and why it really is an American. It's uniquely American, too. So it's a cultural experience.
Gautam, you spent a great deal of time with Tom, and he's very much a family guy, it appears. So I doubt he allows many people. Alex Guerrero, his trainer, Gautam Chopra, you, the filmmaker, are in a situation that few see from an American superstar. Now, and I think we're all creatures of habit, more so as we age, he transitions into not only a new football team, but a different culture, a winning culture to a losing culture, a rigid coach to a loose coach, an old team to a very young team. Just personally watching this, how's the transition been so far for him, like emotionally?
I mean, it's been pretty great. And I think, you know, honestly, it was an emotional, from what I observed, an emotional decision, and in a good way. I think Tom has had, obviously, incredible success, but he needed a challenge. I mean, he still, and I think everybody knows, he still wanted to play. He still felt like he had a lot more in him, but he needed the personal challenge. He needed to sort of reimagine himself, reinvent himself. And so I think all those things you listed were, you know, what really appealed to him, just like the challenge of a new culture, a new place, new teammates, all of that sort of thing. And I think that's the type of thing I've seen in a lot of athletes, especially his caliber, like the elite athletes. It's like they need to find that edge to motivate themselves over and over again.
Yeah.
So I think, you know, that's kind of why Tom left. It wasn't because, you know, the mini dramas that everyone talks about all the time. It was really like it was a personal it was a personal decision, that like a transformation he needed to go through.
It's interesting because my prediction was he would stay because he has such a strong family bond, and I felt New England was his family. And so even though, you know, he'd put his house up for sale, I would say, well, it's, you know, it's a $20 million house or whatever. Those take forever to sell. I wonder how, and I don't know how much of this you know, but I thought leaving New England would be tough, but leaving Bob Kraft would be even tougher because they had a really unique relationship, owner to star player. I wonder now in retrospect if that's accurate, that it wasn't just leaving an area code, a house, a culture. It was leaving somebody he truly loves in Bob Kraft.
Yeah, but I don't think, look, I think he left in a football capacity. He left as a Patriot player, but his bond, especially with his owner, he's talked so much publicly about it as Mr. Kraft being a second father. And I don't really think that changes. I don't think, you know, whether it's 7 years or 8 years from now, when he's in the Hall of Fame, anyone really, I mean, I think they're all on that stage together, including, you know, the coach Belichick. And I just think, you know, this was something he needed in terms of his football life, but I don't think it changes much of his personal life in terms of his, Tom, you know, builds bonds, and he's, you know, since I've worked with him, which now goes back 5 or 6 years, like, I talk to him every few days. He's a very loyal person once that relationship is cemented. And I don't think that changes just because geographically he left to take on a new football challenge.
Is he rational? He's always seemed to me emotionally very disciplined. That always strikes me. Now that doesn't mean he can't yell at a coach on the sideline, Gotham. That's sports. But he's always felt very emotionally disciplined. Is that what you see?
Yeah, he is. He's fiery. You know, it's fun watching like this Jordan doc that everyone's watching and seeing, because on the surface they're very different culturally, very different, you know, just in terms of people. But there's an underlying competitiveness there that's very emotional, that I'd say is very similar. But yeah, I think he's very balanced. He comes from, you know, great family. He's got stable relationships all around him. He's very organized in that way. And Tom is it's very unique in what I've seen, his ability to sort of be on the field, have one persona and turn it off. I mean, as I think a lot of people know from Tom versus Time and some of the other stuff, you know, oftentimes I was going to games with him. Some of them, you know, didn't end up the way he wanted them to. Like, I remember the opening game against the Chiefs several years ago of that season that we filmed. I mean, they got their ass kicked. And, you know, you could see him like in the car on the way home, really pissed off and angry. But gradually, sort of by the time you got home, it's like a 45-minute ride from the stadium to his house, he would sort of just be able to walk into his house. You know, he's got kids that are growing at the time growing up, and he was ready to put them to sleep and be a dad. I mean, it's just something like a lot of guys can't leave it at the field. He really has that ability to emotionally detach from that part of himself.
Gotham Chopra, author, filmmaker, entrepreneur, did Tom versus Time, and now he's helping direct Tom Brady's production company, 199 Productions. You brought up the Michael Jordan documentary. Jason Hare, I had him on a couple of weeks ago. He was fantastic. Now, he has received criticism, you know, especially from a noted documentary filmmaker, Ken Burns, because he thinks MJ had too much influence in the final cut. How hard is it to balance? You're doing a documentary, you're getting incredible access, but it would seem to me there have to be certain agreements. I mean, take me through that process with Tom.
Yeah, you know, I have enormous respect for both of the people. I mean, Ken Burns, of course, the legend, and then Jason, I can only imagine, who I've, you know, gotten to know a little bit. I mean, we've corresponded in the past. He, you know, what he must have had to deal with just in terms of, like, there's the Jordan, there's ESPN, there's Netflix, you know, there's the NBA. And so, I mean, part of your job, first of all, is just being this arbiter between all of these, like negotiating peace in the Middle East. There's so many different interests. But, you know, I'd say that, like, it's changed a lot also. And obviously when you work with high-profile subjects like, you know, Michael Jordan or Tom Brady, I mean, these are at the top of the list. I sort of look at it, it's more of a partnership. I mean, look, I went through this with Kobe, which again is probably only, you know, a smidgen of what Jason dealt with. But it really is a partnership, and you're not doing a reality show. You're not throwing cameras up everywhere, capturing every moment. So it really is like, well, what's the part of the story? What's the part of your story that you want to share? And I think that I can see how a Ken Burns, you know, who's frankly of a different generation and the paragon of that generation, resist that because it's very different than, I guess, you know, what it probably was. And it's not so much a journalistic approach. It's a storytelling approach.
Yeah.
That's kind of how I always, like, even when I start a project with, you know, last year it was with Steph Curry, it's like, hey, we're partners. And I want to, like, have that access. And, you know, I got to know Ayesha Curry and Sonia Curry and, like, the whole family. And it's like, then it's working with them to sort of build this architecture of the story, and also being honest with them when you say, hey, this is not gonna play well. This feels like a vanity thing. And I think once you get to that place where you can have that honest conversation, you know, they also listen. And the smart ones, Tom, you know, being Kobe being the smartest, like Kobe understood, okay, I have to be vulnerable. I have to talk about things that probably are not gonna be comfortable for me, for my family, in order for the audience to really connect with this.
Yeah, I mean, I would imagine Kobe's death was especially hard for somebody like you that went so deep kind of into the certain humanity and the vulnerabilities, the flaws and the strengths of Kobe Bryant. When you look back at your relationship with him, there was every reason for Kobe to be guarded. He had had something happen in his life where there was... Obviously, it was incredibly negative in Colorado. And did you approach Tom, who didn't have that situation, did you approach Tom and Kobe differently? Were you more perhaps delicate with Kobe? Did you have to set ground rules with him? Because they're both American superstars. Yeah. Where was the approach before you started the doc with Tom and Kobe similar or dissimilar?
Well, you know, I think for me... every great project or every project is the function of a relationship. So it's like the process around making the film really comes out of the process of having a relationship. So with Tom, it had been several years. I'd really gotten to know him and his family. And while I think there was a project out in the ether that we sort of talked about, it really took a few years for that trust to be there in order to really embark on that. And I'd say similar with Kobe. Kobe, I'm very different personalities, and but you use the word delicate with Kobe. There was no version of delicate with Kobe. I mean, he's, you know, like Kobe was, he thrived off of confrontation. I mean, we all saw it on the court, and he was at his best, and the team was at its best when he and Shaq were at each other's throats, like literally having fist fights in practice. He sort of thrived off of that sort of confrontation antagonism.
Yeah.
And so the best, yeah, you sort of adapt. And, you know, the good thing is that I'm a fan, too. Like, I'm a huge fan of sports, and I've watched these guys play. And so I guess I sort of observed over time, like, oh, right. Like, with Kobe, like, you just got to get in his face. And, like, and that's how he responds. And, you know, I always used to use the analogy, and, you know, I feel bad, but, like, you know, we all know the legend of Smush Parker.
Yeah.
Kobe did this to every teammate. He just went at them. And he talked to all of his teammates. And, like, when they showed up, you know, in training camp, he went at them. And if you let him run you over, he did. Whereas if you stood up to him, you know, he kind of respected you. And so that was, like, the approach I took with him on the filmmaking. With Tom, who's very sort of collaborative, who recognizes the strengths in his teammates and tries then to adapt it. I mean, he's very demanding. But he is very collaborative in that way. So you're able to sort of have more of a collaborative conversation, I guess. So it's a little bit the same, but it's always also a little bit different because you adapt to the personalities. And you also understand what their strengths are and what they're really going to want to talk about. So you kind of play to that. And then you sort of find the right moment to sort of raise the, okay, but we're also going to have to talk about this thing, whether that's, you know, yeah, Colorado or Deflategate or whatever, you know, all these other things.
Gautam Chopra is joining us, the filmmaker, the entrepreneur, the author, Tom vs. Time, Kobe Bryant's muse. And now he is helping direct Tom Brady's production company, 199 Productions, the spot he was drafted, by the way, 199. First series is Unseen Football. You have a new podcast with your dad, Deepak, about COVID-19. I'll get to that in a second. I do want to address this. You said documentary work is not journalism, but storytelling. I agree, by the way. And I think all documentarians have a bias. I can recall with my wife, Gotham, and you may disagree with this, but during Making a Murder, she was just outraged that he was being framed. And I kept saying, honey, this is not necessarily journalism. He did stalk women, and he tortured animals. That's not normal. The wiring's off here. And I said, and my wife, I kept saying, these are not necessarily journalists. They're telling you a story. And everybody has biases. And in this case, I think they tend to do early, give the benefit of the doubt to the young man who, was ultimately jailed. So when you say you're not, it's not journalism, but storytelling, Gotham, don't you still, though, at a core, a value system, believe you are doing some level of journalism? Because storytelling still has to be accurate, even if it's dramatic.
For sure. No, it's a great question. And look, I think that this idea of objectivity is slightly outdated. We're all subjective. We're all, especially now, we're influenced by the media, we're influenced by social media. We listen, we hear so many different things. And I think it's really important to be upfront, and not to say that that point of view can't change over time, the more you immerse yourself in a story or a character. But I do think, you know, we actually spend a lot of time on the front end, you know, like we sort of agonize, and I torture, like, you know, a lot of the subjects I work with, which is, you know, we need to have a point of view. Like, why are we doing this? What is this about? Like,
right.
These things take time. I mean, working with Kobe was a 2-year process to produce Muse. You know, Tom versus Time, you know, it was across the whole season. Best first of the game last year. Shut Up and Dribble with LeBron, like, a couple years ago. It's like, why are we doing this? We're going, you know, like, a lot of these guys, they don't need to do it. I mean, these are very successful, wealthy, famous. So why are we doing it? Why are we investing this time? Why are we talking about these things? And I think having that point of view, that perspective, is really important. Otherwise, it's sort of like, it's a reality show. I mean, I'm a film snob. So, like, we, you know, I'm always like, hey, we're making a film. We're making a documentary series. We're not just creating a reality show. And I think that's important. I do think, obviously, you have a obligation to the audience and to the people who are also going to invest their time and money in some cases to watch these things, to have a level of honesty and authenticity. So it's a balance. But, you know, I think it's a process, and I really love that process. I love these, you know, and these are relationships. I mean, I stay in touch with Steph, obviously, like I said, talk to Tom all the time. You know, talk to Kobe right, you know, to the end, just in terms of, like, the relationship there. So, you know, it's more than just like, hey, we're just following these guys around for time. It's really sort of immersing in their lives and finding, you know, a way to tell an original story around them.
Is there somebody you have not worked with yet that you have your eye on, a story or a person or a subject?
Yeah, I think, you know, there's always, like, people out there. I find the world of European football and soccer fascinating just in terms of what it means. I think right now, like, you know, this pandemic, we're all feeling, like, the absence of sports, not just because, like, we're NBA fans, but we see, like, the power of sports. You know, my company, which Tom and Michael Strahan are partners in, is called Religion of Sports. And the idea is that sports is not like religion. Sports is a religion. Like, you know, everything we associate with spiritual traditions exists in sports. And, you know, being a fan is being part of something bigger than yourself. And so I think I look at sports that way. So I look 2 years in the future right now at the World Cup and look at, man, like, what is that going to mean for us as a global community? And there are athletes, you know, whether it's, you know, the Ronaldos of the world, or, you know, I'm obsessed with Mohamed Salah, who, you know, plays for Liverpool but comes from Egypt. Like, what do these athletes mean beyond just, like, they're spectacular and they're incredible? But yeah, like I definitely have that short list of people. And just also bigger ideas. I loved working on Shut Up and Dribble a couple years ago with LeBron, which was less about LeBron James. It was more about this thing that he was really passionate about and that he felt, you know, he needed to sort of continue to, you know, wave that flag in terms of what athletes can contribute and how they can be of service. So I thought, you know, that was also a fun project.
By the way, LeBron and Kobe Bryant, you could see similarities, but I think their personalities have uniquely shaped their games. I think Kobe's a little bit more of a taker in his prime. LeBron's a little bit more of a giver. And I think there's a psychology behind that. When you work with LeBron, I would guess, like Brady, he's collaborative because I watch his game, and that's what his game tells me.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you're a fan, so I've watched through the years. Like, okay, you know, when Kevin Love, he literally gets Kevin Love in the right position on the floor, gets him the ball, you know, Ray Allen, like through the years. And whereas Kobe, it's like, okay, Kobe, I mean, and I say this with affection, but when Kobe's on the floor, it's about Kobe.
Yeah.
How do you get Kobe the ball? How do you get Kobe in open space and all of that sort of stuff? So again, you apply that same sort of logic, like off the court when you work with them. I'd say with LeBron, who I never got, you know, I'm not close to LeBron, but what you realize when you start working with him is, oh, Maverick Carter, Rich Paul, like these are the guys that he trusts, that he's built lifelong relationships with. So those are the guys. Like those are the guys you are communicating with every day and figuring out, you know, Randy on his team. And like these are the people who like know, like you can't, you know, when I'm working with Tom or even Kobe, it's like it's texting with them and really getting inside their head. They're very sort of, I mean, controlling is not necessarily the right word. I know it has a bad connotation, but they're very engaged. With LeBron, it's like you, those guys around him, you know, you're texting with, and you're sort of, because they are, I think they're texting with him, they're inside his head. Right. And that comes from a deep bond that they've, you know, had since childhood, basically.
Well, your father is a Deepak Chopra and, you know, a prominent figure in the New Age movement, books, videos, alternative medicine. Really a spokesman long before others, you know, surfaced. And he's obviously had an impact on your life. And I'm interested, you have a new podcast called Now for Tomorrow with your dad. And it's coping with COVID-19 and offering some advice and hope. It's interesting because he knows very well that we have had other pandemics. And we've, you know, viruses are now becoming a real part of our life. But it's really how do governments deal with them? How do individuals and companies deal with it? How do we pivot into business while we're dealing with escalating cases and death? What is the strongest bit of advice? And maybe that's too simplistic, but, you know, how is he dealing with it? And how does he believe we start to heal on this?
Yeah, well, look, he's adapting like everyone else. You know, my dad's life really is traveling around the planet, talking to people, doing workshops, giving speeches, doing that sort of stuff. And so he's had to really scale back. He's all over, you know, the internet doing podcast. Yeah, and so our podcast is a product of that. Like suddenly he couldn't do what he necessarily did. And yet everybody was seeking him out, looking for advice, especially when it came to, you know, the anxiety people are feeling, all the stress around the uncertainty of the future. When's this thing going to end? When can we go back out there? You know, et cetera. So, you know, I think his advice is, first of all, like, hey, we have this time. We're all in our houses. We're all being forced in some ways to reflect. So, like, what are the things? How do you want to prepare? Look, whether it's 1 week from now, 1 month from now, 1 year from now, when we're able to go out there and sort of operate under some sense of normalcy, what can you do now to prepare for tomorrow? And some of these things are just simple. Like, you know, it's like people are feeling insomnia. So here's some advice on how to navigate that. Or there's like these sort of, you know, one of the things we talked about, and I think it's like in the first few episodes of the podcast, is forgiveness. A lot of people hold grudges. They're carrying around like these sort of toxic emotions. And so how can they use this time to sort of rid themselves and exercise and cleanse themselves? So there's sort of these simple, like 5 to 7 minute instructional things, which he's really good at. Like, you know, the thing I sort of constantly fight with my dad is he's very existential. Like he loves his head is in the clouds. He's always talking about consciousness and stuff like that. And I'm always like, yeah. But like, how does that help me now? And this sort of presented like the, you know, the, a great opportunity. Like we're juggling like existential questions about like, man, like how did we get here? What does this mean? What does the future look like? But with very practical issues of like, well, I can't sleep at night, so help me with that. So, you know, that's kind of my dad and my sort of constant back and forth. But it's fun. You know, we're very close. And so, you know, it was a cool project to work on.
Yeah, as I watched Michael Jordan's documentary, Episode 7 is Sunday, and I watched it a couple days ago, got lucky and a quick glimpse at it. And when his father died, you know, Michael showed incredible resilience emotionally. And he said, you know, my dad was always about, his messaging was always about, you know, it, win the day, there's a positive in down times. And Michael, despite this incredibly close relationship with his dad, you know, he was in the middle of his life and was very resilient and really took up, had to go to church a few days later and address people, family members. I was struck by Michael's strength. And similarly, in a crisis, he found a silver lining and the greatness and the depth he had with his dad and appreciated the relationship as he mourned it. And it's funny as I hear you talk and I think about Michael's documentary, you know, I've tried to tell my kids, I would never, I'm on a treadmill doing a 3-hour show. I would never get this time with you. My daughter's probably going to do her studies now from home for a year. And I'm like, I feel so lucky that I'm in this situation. How have you personally, beyond your father, how have you personally dealt with this as somebody who's ambitious, likes to work, is in the middle of a new project? Has it ever been tough for you?
Yeah, I mean, well, first of all, you know, it's been tough for me, but, you know, not nearly as tough for me as obviously it has been for millions of people around the country and around the planet. Yes, I have not been home like this for, I don't know, you know, my wife jokes, like, since we've been married, I don't think I've been home this long. But, you know, because of that, I have a 12-year-old son. I'm, you know, having dinner with him every night.
Yep.
We have a ritual now. We're watching Lost. You know, we started from the beginning. We're watching it together. And, yeah, I'm having, you know, these are things that I never really paid much attention to. In some ways, I'm really enjoying it. Like, we go for runs in the morning. So I'm really, like, bonding with my son. I would say that's the most, you know, that's been the best part of this, kind of like you were saying with your daughter. I think it's also, you know, something I love sports. And, you know, everything about my life and professionally is about sports. But it's really, I think, something I've thought a lot about in the last few weeks is tapping the wisdom of sports. Like, you know, I've gotten the privilege of working with all of these great athletes. But like, what can we take from their successes and all these things that you hear about, you know, all these expressions that we all control what you can control, you know, leave it out on all of the field, all the kind of cliches, but like, how do those apply? You know, I'm never going to be an elite athlete, but like, how do they apply off the field, off the court? And I'll tell you one story. I love the, like what you just said about Michael Jordan. And I thought a lot about Kobe, obviously because of his passing, but even like, how would he react to this situation we're in? And I remember a story from a couple of years ago, like when I was working with him on Muse, we were watching a Brooklyn Nets game. I'm not going to name the player, but there was a player who went 0-for-9 in the first half of the game. And then in the second half, he didn't take a single shot. He was 0-for-9 at the end of the game. And I said something to Kobe, like, man, that's really kind of crazy that he didn't, you know, take a... And Kobe said, you know what, man? I would be 0-for-49 before I just stopped shooting the ball. And he's like, you know why? Because, like, maybe it's that 47th shot that's going to go in. Maybe it's that 48. Maybe it's that 49. I would never stop shooting. I would never lose hope, like, that the next one is the one. And I kind of think about that a lot in terms of the current context. Like, I think we all kind of are having difficulty waking up and going through the same routine. And, man, when is this thing going to end? When can I get back out there? But, like, me, the sort of Mamba mentality is, like, Kobe would wake up every morning thinking, you know what? This could be the day. This will be the day where it's going to turn around. And if it's not today, it could be tomorrow. It could be a week from now. And I think just like that sort of mentality of like, how do we mine the wisdom of sports and apply it to life is something I think about a lot these days. And it does. It helps me sort of figure out like, okay, I'm going to be resilient. You know, all these guys talk about like it's failure and resilience that teaches you the most about yourself. Michael Jordan always used to talk about that. It's like everyone talks about the game winners I've hit. Nobody talks about, you know, the dozens and dozens, if not hundreds of shots that I've taken that I've, you know, in critical situations that I've missed. But I remember all of those. And so I think that's something I definitely, you know, I think I've tried to utilize in this time.
Yeah, I was told years ago by a very successful person, you have to be optimistic to get rich. You can't be cynical. You can't be snarky. And he said, because there's so many roadblocks, you'll talk yourself out of the future. And I think Michael Jordan and Kobe and Tom Brady at their epicenter are optimistic people. You have to be. And as I watch on social media, some people unravel emotionally with this virus. I wake up every day and I feel like I'm an optimistic person. And I think it gets me to day two and day three and month four and month five. And I always do feel like the Kobes and the MJs and the Bradys, they wake up feeling they're going to succeed. And that's what gets them through these really rough series. I mean, if you look at the Michael Jordan documentary, Gotham, Lord, he was tackled for years by the Pistons. I mean, the physical toll it took on him. And the physical toll then, of course, becomes, becomes the emotional toll and the mental toll. So I do think positivity in these dark stages is a thing. Like you've dealt with all these stars before. It feels like it's hard to be negative and successful long term. Is that sound reasonable?
For sure. I mean, you know, I don't think I've ever really talked to anyone about this, but I was when we worked with Tom across the Tom vs. Time season, which culminated in the Super Bowl against the Eagles, and it was in Minnesota, freezing cold Minnesota. And I just remember how sad that was. And by the way, when we got there, Tom like just restricted access. Like I didn't really even interact with him at all in freezing cold Minneapolis. It was a miserable experience in general, especially as a Patriots fan. But the next year when I was in Atlanta, I went and Tom invited me, and we were not filmed. We continued to capture content just kind of like Michael did, sort of like, hey, who knows, someday in the future, this may be valuable. And so he actually was a very different person. He was like, his mentality was different. And I was with him like 24 hours before the Super Bowl in his hotel room. And we were just talking, and he had this ability to take what had been, I remember, a tragedy the year before and spin it into something very positive. And he told me, he said, listen, remember how terrible it was last year against the Eagles and afterwards, and how sad everyone and how depressed he was? He had sort of taken that experience and sort of retrofitted it into like motivation. And he was like, listen, had we not lost that game, I am convinced we would not be here. I would not be here today ready to play the Rams, you know, tomorrow. And I'm telling you, I mean, Tom, very confident, very optimistic. He said, we're going to win. Trust me. It's going to be a very different game. We're going to win, but we're going to win because of what we endured last year. And again, I just like that was these guys just have this ability to sort of always find the edge. Like, what is it that, you know, is going to motivate them, especially the ones who are at the, you know, they've had these long careers. They got to find that thing that's really personal to them. And I think that sense of optimism and hope and belief in self, irrational, frankly, at times, is pretty inspiring.
Gotham Chopra, new podcast now for tomorrow with his legendary father, Deepak Chopra, coping with COVID-19. You can check that out. Absolute pleasure. We don't talk to you enough. You're smart, you're thoughtful, you're mindful, and you make me think, and you do terrific work. And I can't wait to watch Unseen Football. And thank you for, you know, taking 40 minutes, 35 minutes of your life. I appreciate that.
I love, you know, being with you, and it's always fun and stimulating. So thanks for having me. Anytime.
All right, our first interview on our Saturday podcast. That was interesting. Deals with Kobe, Tom Brady, great documentarian, smart guy. Now, let's get ready for a little curveball. You know, through the years, I try to bring on people on my Saturday podcast to throw a little curveball at you. And I thought, we got into a discussion on the show this week. I thought, George Norrie would be perfect. He is the host of Coast to Coast AM on Premier Radio Networks. on an unbelievable 600 stations in North America. He is the most listened to overnight radio program ever and is broadcasting live Monday through Sunday at 1 to 5 a.m. Eastern. Now, when you do a show at 1 to 5 a.m., and I've listened to shows, George's, you get different callers and different ideas. It's a different culture. It's ultimately very fascinating. And he captivates listeners with discussions on paranormal phenomena, abductions, conspiracy. It is a totally different show than what I do. But he's also the author of a half a dozen books. Last year, Mad as Hell. And it's a fascinating program. And we got into this discussion this week about I've always been not a cynic, but I've always kind of kept conspiracy theories at arm's distance and UFO discussions. I had an experience, which I'll get into with George. I had it in college, which is I've discussed it only once or twice on the air in 25 years. But recently there was video that the Pentagon acknowledged and released. And it was only the first or second time in my life that I saw a video and I thought, all right, that's the closest I've come to a UFO. Is it Russia's? Is it China's? Is it ours? When you have Navy pilots that are flummoxed and flabbergasted, we need to discuss this. And so I bring in George Norrie, host of Coast to Coast. So let me start with this. You do a show in the AM, 1 to 5 AM. It is different. Most people are asleep. So let's describe first, George, for people who haven't heard your show. You get a very lively audience, and I would argue it's much different than a 9 a.m. to noon audience, right?
It sure is, Colin. Our audience, and they say that people stay up late. About 33% of the American public, for example, stays up late in the hours I'm on. But they're different kinds of folks. I mean, yes, they're police officers and hospital employees and truck drivers and people who work the night shift. But we have a lot of people who are just plain insomniacs. They can't go to sleep.
Yes.
They lay in their bed and they listen to the radio and they interact. They make phone calls. It's a different world out there in the wee hours. And we cater to that, as you just said, every night.
Now, I want to focus in on a couple of pieces of video or pictures I've seen. Now, let me play, if not devil's advocate, critic. I'll say, you know, listen, if a government, and we all know there's missiles pointed at us and missiles pointed at Russia. We all know that governments have secret covert projects, and they've got to put them out there sometime. They're flying in the skies, George, at some point. And if you find something at, you know, 10 a.m. Or 10 p.m. over the Pacific Ocean, why could it not just be China or our government testing a new space, going to a new frontier with a new device?
You can't rule it out. Absolutely, you cannot rule it out. Does Russia, does China possess something more advanced than what we have? I doubt that. So then we look at the next possibility. Is it ours? Did we not even tell our own Navy pilots that you just made reference to that we have this kind of technology because it's so secret? That's a possibility. But the strange part about this is people have been seeing objects in the skies since the beginning of time. And just recently, there's a group that is a private group that uncovered these videos. And the Pentagon, just as you mentioned, released the fact that it is real. There's something there. We don't know what it is. I mean, they didn't come out and say these were extraterrestrials, but they are indeed UFOs, which stands for unidentified flying objects. That's what they are. And these Navy pilots, who you can hear on these little snippets, I mean, they're just enthralled. They don't know what's going on. They can't catch them. They're in shock. Something's happening. My guess is, I don't think it's ours, because we probably would have used it somewhere before in order to muscle up other countries. It's got to be coming from some other place.
You know, when I grew up in Nevada, my early years in broadcasting, and there was Area 51. And for years and years, we heard stories that people would see things around Area 51. And, you know, I mean, legitimate reporters I work with, Dan Burns was one, a very legitimate news reporter. And it wasn't long after that that the stealth in the Gulf War was introduced. I connected the dots and thought, well, Area 51 would be a place they tested them. And there's a lot of space between Vegas and Barstow. And so when you hear Area 51, is it reasonable to assume at least the early sightings could have possibly been the stealth?
Yes, it's very possible. Back in 1947, when Ken Arnold was one of the first to report seeing UFOs in the skies over Washington, he, you know, saw several objects
yes.
flying around. They could have been ours. There's no question about that. But that was back in 1947. Today, yeah, you have to weigh the possibilities. And, you know, the easy thing, Colin, is just to tell yourself, this vast universe, can we really be alone? And I have to say the answer is no. There could be billions of other civilizations out there that have had millions of years advanced time on us. There are others that are probably still primitive and cave-type people. But there's no question in my mind, if I had to bet the ranch, that there are extraterrestrials out there.
So another piece of evidence I found fascinating, and again, my initial response, George Norrie joining us, is always to be, okay, it couldn't be like the Phoenix Lights, for instance. You know, my takeaway after watching those several times is, are they reflecting on something? The way they blinked. I don't have an answer, but I want to segue to the O'Hare incident in 2006, where it never showed up on radar, but there are multiple pictures. Some have been doctored, most haven't that I've seen, on a circular object over the tarmac. The pilot saw it. Employees of the airline saw it, but it didn't show up on radar. Now, there are There are situations meteorologically, George, where clouds, you get these funnels within clouds, and it can do some dark gray shading. That was my ultimate guess. But the more I look at the pictures, they look disc-like. Have you ever interviewed anybody regarding that?
I sure did some time ago. And you're right. When you look at clouds, first of all, it could be anything. As a matter of fact, every once in a while, I see my Uncle Albert up there. He looks like a cloud. So, you know, you can assume a lot of things. In this O'Hare incident from several years ago, what could have looked like a cloud turned into something else because this thing kept coming down, down, down. And the people that we've talked to over the years, witnesses, they clearly think that this is very unusual, and it wasn't a meteorological cloud pattern by any means.
George Norrie joining us. So I'll tell you my experience. I had two. First in college was explained. I was driving from Cheney, Washington to Spokane. I went to college in Cheney, and there were about six guys in the car. Jeff Bradbury, Terry Hollingsworth, Dan Shelton, Brett Weeke. I can remember the guys. And we looked off into the horizon, and there was a massive fireball coming down. I discovered 30 years later, watching Dateline or 2020, that it was actually a rock that hit a car in upstate New York, and it was seen all across America. But we didn't have the internet then to explain it. There's actually a name for that rock or boulder that hit the back of a car, and it all across America at that time in that year, I traced it back, it was simply a space rock that came down and created a real tail. The second one's not explainable. It was before that. So I'm driving home with Mark Fisher out of my high school in my Buick Grand Sport car, or maybe my AMC Pacer, and we're driving home late at night from Eastern Washington to our small town on the coast of Washington. And I remember it clear as day. He was asleep. I pull up to my driveway on the coast of Washington. My house is about 75 yards up a road. No trees. You can see it clearly on the coast of Washington. And in a small town, no streetlights really, I say, Mark, wake up. What's above my house? It was a flashing light. And it was a Frank Lloyd Wright design, flat roof, and about 100 feet above it was flashing lights. And Mark turns and looks, and I turn off my car, and I said, I want to hear it. And we poked our head out the window, and we couldn't hear it. So I started my car back up, and we drove very quickly into my driveway, turned into it, and it went out and up. I've told this story twice. And John Goulet, my producer, shaking my head. I went into the house with my mom and said, did you hear that? And she goes, what are you talking about? I said, Mom, there was literally something over the house. It was flashing. I'm like, Mom, I'm not into this stuff. It wasn't a helicopter because you couldn't hear it, and it was too fast for a plane, and it went out and up. And it was the only time in my life where drones did not exist that I had, and I've talked about it. I've said, listen, do I believe in UFOs? I don't know, but I know what I saw. So as I tell you that story, what is your takeaway?
Well, there's something that you saw that was very, very unusual. I had a similar experience. As you know, Colin, I speak at a lot of events all around the country.
Yeah.
And over the past several years, with my producer, Tom Danheiser, we would be there, you know, having lunch, waiting for the event to start or something like that. And we noticed a guy would sit behind me at a different table with a brown paper bag on his table. And this happened 3 to 4 times all around the country. The same guy with a paper bag sitting right next to me, just kind of like staring or looking. And probably after the 4th time in some city, I said, Tom, there's something wrong here. There's something very strange. We got to be careful about this guy. On the last time, the 4th or 5th time that we saw him, he reaches into his paper bag. And I said, Tom, you better throw your body on me to protect me. I'm the talent. You're the producer. And he said, what's in that bag? The guy reaches in. I honestly thought it was a gun. Pulls out night vision goggles. Comes up to us after like 2 years of just sitting next to me. Introduces himself. The guy's dead now. His name was Ed Grimsley. And he said, I'm looking at UFOs on the top of the building of this hotel tonight. Would you join me? And I look at this guy and go, no. And he said, come on, I've got a whole bunch of other people coming. And then some other guests from this event came by and said, yeah, we're going up there. So I said, okay, we will. We go on the top of the roof. He pulls off these night vision goggles and he said, look in this area right here. Because with the naked eye, you couldn't see anything. With the goggles, you could see everything. And I'm looking at two objects doing 90-degree turns way up there, stopping, starting, moving, going. It was absolutely riveting. Two objects I saw that I'd have to classify as UFOs. So back to your story, whatever you saw, I think, was probably out of this world.
George Norrie is joining us. Are there conspiracy theories that you don't believe?
There are lots of conspiracy theories that I don't believe. There are a lot of fake news stories that pop up that I don't believe. One was the coronavirus was, I believe it was created in the lab. I think it got out accidentally in China, in Wuhan, because they have a viral lab there. But I don't believe it was concocted to crush the presidency of Donald Trump. So you hear things like that, and you have to put them in perspective. And in this particular case, this conspiracy theory has partial merit. How was it created? Where was it created? But the reason for it, you have to weigh out. But there are a lot of conspiracy theories out there that pop up. The JFK theory of what happened to him, though it's a conspiracy theory, I think that's got some legs to it. I think Lee Harvey Oswald either was a patsy, as he said, or acted or did not act alone. There's no question about that in my mind. So there's a lot of things out there that are conspiracy theories, but you can't believe everyone you hear, because if you do, you're going to go crazy. I've got a friend of mine who lives in St. Louis. This guy believes every conspiracy theory that you could say. I mean, everything. And he believes them all. And I keep telling him, I said, John, no, 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 maybe, yes, no, 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 no. And you just need to be careful with these things.
George Norrie joining us, 600-plus radio stations across America, coast-to-coast AM. Years ago, I lived in Washington State. You'd have, because you had a lot of space, and when I grew up as a kid, Seattle was a moderately sized city, but it was a state without a lot of cities. And when you don't have the lights, the urban lights, you can see to the sky and see falling stars. And sometimes less populated states, you get to see more. When my stepson went camping in Utah last year, he's like, I've never seen. He grew up in the East Coast. He's like, I've never seen the sky. It's amazing what's up there. And so in Washington State, there'd be UFO sightings. And so I hear about it a lot. And I've through the years, you see that some are doctored. I think people have gotten more sophisticated in terms of there's more critics and more cynics. It doesn't feel to me, and maybe I'm wrong with CGI, it feels like I'm now seeing a lot of videos that don't appear to be doctored. I just don't know what they are. Do you think it's harder to doctor things now based on our years of seeing fakes and frauds and doctored photos and the like?
If anything, Colin, it's probably easier to doctor things. They can come up with stuff that is so authentic looking that it'll boggle your mind. And the only way you're going to find out if it's not real is by taking it to experts in computer-generated graphics and animation who can study this frame by frame. And they'll tell you, oh, no, this was put in. Look at that. I mean, they literally could make you or me in some event and put us in this event, and we're not even there. I mean, that's how good it is these days. So you do have to look at everything with a little weary eye because of the ability of technology to create these things. They can even do it with voices now. We could take your entire podcast, grab snippets, and make you say something totally different from what you said.
I was always interested with D.B. Cooper because I grew up around 15 minutes, maybe 45 minutes away from where the appearance of D.B. Cooper took place. And so, there's been a lot of people that have pursued this. And, I go either way on it. What I find fascinating with the D.B. Cooper story is I think it's very hard to believe he lived jumping out of a plane, but I don't think it's impossible. And I also think there are often interesting people who simply line up and it's either coincidental or it's dark or it's him. Is there one person? Because I've gone to the D.B. Cooper stuff. I've gone down that wormhole for 25 years. My audience rolls their eyes at me, but I've been fascinated by it because it's in my neck of the woods. Is there somebody you believe that did survive it? Is there a primary suspect in your opinion?
No, there's no question. The D.B. Cooper hijacking case where he jumped out of a plane with a satchel of cash is a remarkable story. Let me tell you what happened sometime after that. A fellow in the Detroit area surveyed airports to ascertain, this is after D.B. Cooper, which were the easiest airports to get through and get on a plane and hijack it for money. And the guy's still alive. He lives in St. Louis. And he decided that the St. Louis airport was the airport to get through. He came through with a shot-off rifle, got on an American Airlines plane out of St. Louis years ago, hijacked it. They gave him $500,000. He had no experience jumping out of a plane, but he had a parachute with him and everything else. I mean, now you can't get any of that through TSA. And he let all the passengers go. There were 80 passengers, kept the crew. And as the plane was taking off where he was going to then jump out of the plane, a cowboy in the St. Louis area got his Cadillac, got through to the airport, got on the runway, and smashed into the jet that they were in and knocked out the tail portion of it, of the plane, and the plane crashes and goes down. It hadn't launched yet, but it crashes onto the runway. They get another plane for the guy because he's still got the crew with him, and he claims he's got a bomb on plane. So they bring him another plane. They all get on. A new crew is there. He takes a stewardess with him as hostage. He's got a gun, and he's got a satchel of cash, and they get on this other plane, and they take off. Now, he's over the skies somewhere, and he jumps. And he has no experience jumping. He survives. On his way down, he drops the cash, the satchel of cash. It's gone. But he lands. They arrest him. They find him. They actually find the guy. They arrest him. They ended up finding where the money was. And he had like 20 to 25 years in jail. And he's out. He's going to be on Coast to Coast sometime this year after some Hollywood producers are done signing him up for a movie. They've got him. They got his rights to do that.
Martin McNally.
That's it. Absolutely. That's Martin. So to answer your question, yes, D.B. Cooper, I believe, jumped out of that plane and survived because this guy did, and he had no experience.
Isn't that fact? I had never heard this story. As you told it, I looked it up. I'm going to read this when I hang up with you. Oh, my gosh.
It's a great story.
This is my, George, you ruined my entire weekend. This is my forget Netflix. Forget The Last Dance.
What are you doing without any sports teams doing anything?
Well, you're talking about D.B. Cooper. I mean, you figure it out. We're broadcasters, George. That's what we do. We broadcast. George Norrie is joining us, Coast to Coast, Premier Radio Network, 600-plus stations. By the way, the Murder Hornet has been introduced to the U.S. now. It's called the Murder Hornet. It's a deadly insect. I watched a video yesterday. A praying mantis ate one alive. Don't mess with a praying mantis.
They're tough.
Yeah, but the Murder Hornet. Give me the genesis of this, and are you talking about this on your show?
Yes, we are, and investigative reporter Cheryl Jones, who used to work with CNN, is going to do a report on this in about a month. But this is a horrible hornet that apparently came out of Asia. How it got here, nobody knows, probably on some kind of cargo ship or something like that. It's about 2 inches long. If you get stung by it, it's going to hurt you. If you get stung a couple times by it, it could kill you, whether you're allergic to bee stings or not. These things are horrible. And what they do is when they attack bee colonies, honeybee colonies, they take off their heads, they rip them apart and everything else. These are horrible critters. And they're as big as a baby hummingbird. I mean, could you imagine a bee 2 inches long landing on you? Oh, my God.
Has there ever been anybody, give me an example, not many if you had one, that had a conspiracy theory or had information and then it was later unveiled to be true? Because people feel less reluctant to call your show, you will enable them and help them. That somebody called your show, had information, you may even have been skeptical, and it was later key evidence or a gateway to confirming something that really was happening.
I think the most obvious one is what we've been talking about, and that is the UFO subject, where people will report things, and then later on governments will admit there's something weird and strange here. That's vindication, as far as I'm concerned. I had a police officer call me one night on the show, and he said, George, we got a call that a guy had been dying of a heart attack. So we got to the house before even the EMT group gets there. And a little old man opens the door for us. We come in and see a little old man lying on his stomach, almost dead, probably dead, on the floor. We roll him over. It's the guy who opened the door. We turn around and he's gone. The dead man, his spirit, opened the door. Now, this is a police officer telling me this story. I believe the guy.
Yeah, I don't know what to make of it. I've had some strange relationships and strange moments. But you get calls like that regularly, right?
All the time. When we do open lines, every once in a while, Fridays especially, anything happens.
George Norrie, Coast to Coast, new book, Mad as Hell. Fascinating stuff. You know, I used to be much more often up at that time anymore, but there was a time in my life at the beginning of your broadcasting nationally. It was the end of Art and the beginning of you when because of my schedule, I was up at that time. So it's a fascinating listen for people, that people feel less reluctant to share themselves, be vulnerable, and tell George what they hear and what they see. Give it a listen, 1 to 5 Eastern AM, Monday through Sunday. Fascinating discussions. And it seems like to me, people are less trusting of the government and the media, more so than any time in my life. Do you believe, George, before I let you go, that has increased the number of conspiracy theories because we don't trust our leaders?
It sure has added to that. I mean, the days of Walter Cronkite, when you could watch television news and think, this guy's telling me the truth, they're gone. Because cable news has become so opinionated, where, you know, one cable company leans left, another cable company leans right, and you don't know what to believe anymore, and you don't know who to believe it from, and that does create more and more conspiracy theories because you just can't trust certain things. I mean, we got into Vietnam with a phony Gulf of Tonkin episode that two of our ships were attacked. It never happened, and they admitted that years later. You have to be able to trust government, and right now, a lot of people don't.
George Norrie, what a pleasure. Next time you're in town, I want to have lunch.
You got it. Maybe I'll buy.
That would be even better. Thank you, George.
Thanks, Colin.